But the old man had said Kansas City. He would take a dim view of a substitute. Finally, I drove the belt around Macon and pulled into a landing flat on the far side. There, I queued up for local traffic launching and heading for Kansas City in a mess of farmers' copters and such like local craft. I would have to hold local speeds all across the state, but that was safer than getting into the hot pattern, with my transponder identifying my car to every block control station. The field was automatically serviced. No attendance. Not even at the fueling line. It seemed probable that I had managed to enter the Missouri traffic pattern without arousing suspicion. True, there was a block control station back in Illinois which might be wondering where I had gone, but that did not matter. Kansas City is an old-fashioned city. It was not hurt in the bombings, except on the east side where Independence used to be. Consequently, it was never rebuilt. From the southeast, you can drive almost downtown, as far as Swope Park, without having to choose between parking or paying toll to enter the city proper. One can fly in and make another choice. Land in the landing flats near north of the Missouri River and take the tunnels into the city, or land on the downtown platforms south of Memorial Hill. I decided against both of these. I wanted the car near me, but I did not want to have to pick it up through a checking system. If it came to a pinch, I could not shoot my way out while offering my combo to a parking attendant. I did not like tunnels in a pinch either, nor launching platform elevators. A man can be trapped in such. Frankly, I did not want to go into the city at all. I roaded the car on Route 40 and drove into the Mayor Boulevard toll gate. The line waiting to pay toll for the doubtful privilege of driving on the city street was quite long. I began to feel hemmed in as soon as another car filled in behind me, and wished mightily that I had decided to park and go in by the public passenger ways. But the gatekeeper took my toll without glancing at me. I glanced at him all right, but could not tell whether or not he was being ridden. I drove through the gate with a sigh of relief, only to be stopped just beyond the gate. A barrier dropped in front of me, and I just managed to stop the car, whereupon a cop stuck his head in the side I had opened. "Safety check," he said. "Climb out." I protested that my car had just been inspected. "No doubt," he agreed, "but the city is having a safety drive. Here's your car check. Pick it up just beyond the barrier. Now get out and go in that door." He pointed to a low building a few steps from the curb. "For what?" "Eyesight and reflexes," he explained. "Come on, you're holding up the line." In my mind's eye, I saw the map, with Kansas City glowing red. That the city was secured, I was sure. Therefore, this mild-mannered policeman was almost surely hag-ridden. I did not need to look at his shoulders. But, short of shooting him and making an emergency takeoff from that spot, there was nothing I could do but comply. With a normal, everyday cop, I would have tried the bribe direct, slipping him money as he handed me my car check. But Titans don't use money. Nor do they. I got out, grumbling, and walked slowly toward the building. The door near me was marked in. There was one at the far end marked out. A man came out from it as I approached. I wanted very badly to ask him what he had found. It was a temporary building with an old-style unpowered door. I pushed it open with a toe and glanced both sides and up before I entered. It seemed safe. Inside was an empty anteroom with open door beyond. Someone inside called out, "Come in." Still as cautious as the setup permitted, I went in. There were two men, both in white coats, one with a doctor's speculum strapped to his head. He looked up and said briskly, "This won't take a minute. Step over here." He closed the door I had entered. I heard the latch click. It was a sweeter setup than we had worked out for the Constitution Club. Had I had time, I would have admired it. Spread out on a long table were transit cells for masters, already opened and warmed. The second man had one ready, for me, I knew, and was holding it tilted toward him, so that I could not see the slug inside. The transit cells would not arouse alarm in the minds of victims. Medical men always have things at hand which are odd to the layman. As for the rest, I was being invited to place my eyes against the goggles of a quite ordinary visual acuity tester. The doctor would keep me there, blindfolded without knowing it, and reading test figures, while his assistant fitted me with a master. No violence, no slips, no protests. It was not even necessary, as I had learned during my own service, to bare the victim's back. Just touch the master to the bare neck, then let the new recruit himself adjust his clothing to cover his master before he left. "Right over here," the doctor repeated. "Place your eyes against the eyepieces." Moving very quickly, I went to the bench on which was mounted the acuity tester and started to comply. Then I turned suddenly around. The assistant had moved in closer. The cell was ready in his hands. As I turned, he tilted it away from me. "Doctor," I said, "I wear contact lenses. Should I take them off?" "No, no," he snapped. "Let's not waste time." "But, doctor," I protested, "I want you to see how they fit. Now, I've had a little trouble with this left one." I lifted both hands and pulled back the upper and lower lids of my left eye. "See?" He said angrily, "This is not a clinic. Now, if you please." They were both within reach. Lowering my arms in a mighty bear hug, I got them both and grabbed with clutched fingers at the spot between each set of shoulder blades. With each hand, I struck something soft and mushy under the coats and felt revulsion shake me at the touch. I once saw a cat struck by a ground car. The poor thing leapt straight up about 4 feet with its back arched the wrong way and all limbs flying. These two unlucky men did the same sort of thing. They contorted in every muscle in a grand spasm, as if every motor cell in each body had been stimulated at once. Which is perhaps just what happened when I clutched and crushed their masters. I could not hold them. They jerked out of my arms and flopped to the floor. But there was no need to hold them. After that first bone-shaking convulsion, they went limp, unconscious, possibly dead. Someone was knocking at the door. I called out, "Just a moment, the doctor is busy." The knocking stopped. I made sure that the door was fastened, then went back, bent over the doctor, and pulled up his coat to see what I had done to his master. The thing was a ruptured, slimy mess, already beginning to stink. So was the one on the other man, which facts pleased me heartily, as I was determined to burn the slugs if they were not already dead. But I was not sure that I could do so without killing the hosts as well. I left the men, to live or die, or be seized again by Titans, as might be. I had no way to help them. The masters waiting in their cells were another matter. With a fan beam and a max charge, I burned them all in seconds only. There were two large crates against the wall. I did not know that they contained masters, but I had no reason to believe otherwise. I beamed them through and through until the wood charred. The knocking at the door resumed. I looked around hastily for somewhere to hide the two men. There was nowhere at all. So, I decided to execute the classic military maneuver. I was about to go out the exit. I felt that something was missing. I hesitated and looked around again. The room was almost bare. There seemed to be nothing suited to my purpose. I could use clothing from the doctor or his helper, but I did not want to touch them. Then I noticed the dust cover for the acuity tester lying on the bench. I loosened my shirt, snatched up the dust cover, wadded it up, and stuffed it in my shirt between my shoulder blades. With my shirt collar fastened and the jacket zipped tightly, it made a bulge of the proper size. Then I went out. A stranger and afraid, into a world I never made. As a matter of fact, I was feeling pretty cocky. Another cop took my car check. He glanced sharply at me, then motioned me to climb in. I did so, and he said, "Go to police headquarters, under the city hall." "Police headquarters, the city hall," I repeated, and gunned her ahead. I started in that direction and turned onto Nicholas Freeway. I came to a stretch where traffic thinned out and punched the button to shift license plates, hoping that no one would notice. It seemed possible that there was already a call out for the plates I had been showing at the toll gate. I wished that I had been able to change the car's colors and body lines as well. Before the freeway reached McGee Traffic Way, I turned into a down ramp and stuck thereafter to residential side streets. It was 1800, zone 6 time, and I was due in Washington in 4.5 hours. The city did not look right. I tried to discount my own keyed-up state and to see what was actually there, not what I expected to see, nor what I was expected to see. Superficially, there was nothing wrong, but it did not have the right flavor, as if it were a clumsily directed play. I kept trying to put my finger on it. It kept slipping away. Kansas City has many wide neighborhoods, made up of family units a century old or more. Time seems to have passed them by. Kids roll on lawns, and householders sit in the cool of the evening on the front porches, just as their great-grandparents did. If there are bomb shelters around, they did not show. The queer, old, bulky houses, fitted together piece by piece by guildsmen long since dead, have homely charm. Seeing them, one wonders how Kansas City got its gamey reputation. Those old neighborhoods feel like an enclave of security, impregnable, untouchable. I cruised through, dodging dogs and rubber balls and toddlers who chased after them, and tried to get the feel of the place. It was the slack of the day, the time for the first drink, for watering lawns, and for neighborly chats. And it seemed so. Ahead of me, I saw a woman bending over a flower bed. She was wearing a sunsuit, and her back was as bare as mine. More so, for I had the wad of cloth stuffed under my jacket. But clearly she was not wearing a master, nor were the two young kids with her. So what could be wrong? It was a hot day, hotter even than Washington had been. I began to look for bare shoulders. Sun-suited women and men in shorts and sandals, Kansas City, despite its reputation, is in the Bible Belt and feels its puritanical influence. People there do not strip to the weather with the cheerful unanimity of Laguna Beach or Coral Gables. An adult fully covered up is never conspicuous, even on the hottest day. So I found people dressed both ways. But the proportions were wrong. Sure, there were plenty of kids dressed for the weather. But in several miles of driving, I saw the bare backs of only 5 adult women and 2 adult men. I should have seen more like 500. It was a hot day. Cipher it out. While some jackets undoubtedly did not cover masters, by simple proportion, well over 90% of the population must be possessed. This city was not secured the way we had secured New Brooklyn. This city was saturated. The masters did not simply hold key points and key officials. The masters were the city. I felt a panicky urge to blast right off from the street and streak out of zone red at emergency maximum. They knew that I had escaped a tollgate trap. They would be looking for me. I might be the only free man driving a car in the entire city, and they were all around me. I fought it down. An agent who gets his wind up is no use to himself or his boss, and is not likely to get out of a tight spot. But I had not fully recovered from what it had done to me to be possessed. It was hard to be calm. I counted 10, delayed my reactions, and tried to figure the situation. It seemed that I must be wrong. There could not possibly be enough masters available to permit them to saturate a city with 1 million population. I remembered my own experiences hardly 2 weeks earlier. I recalled how we picked our recruits and made each new host count. Of course, that had been a secondary invasion, in which we had depended on shipments, whereas Kansas City almost certainly had had a flying saucer land nearby. Still, it did not make sense. It would have taken, I felt sure, not one saucer, but 12 or more, to carry enough masters to saturate Kansas City. If there had been that many, surely the space stations would have spotted them, radar-tracked their landing orbits. Or could it be that they had no trajectories to track? That they simply appeared, instead of swooping down like a rocket? Maybe they used that hypothetical old favorite, the space-time warp. I did not know what a space-time warp was, and I doubted if anyone knew, but it would do to tag a type of landing which could not be spotted by radar. We did not know what the masters were capable of in the way of engineering, and it was not safe to judge their limitations by our own. But the data I had led to a conclusion which contradicted common logic. Therefore, I must check before I reported back. One thing seemed sure. If I assumed that the masters had in fact almost saturated the city, then it was evident that they were still keeping up the masquerade. For the time being, they were permitting the city to look like a city of free human beings. Perhaps I was not as conspicuous as I feared. While I was thinking, I had moseyed along another mile or so, going nowhere. Once, I found myself heading into the retail district around the plaza. I swung away. Where there are crowds, there are cops. But I skimmed the edge of the district, and in so doing passed the public swimming pool. I observed it and filed what I had seen. My mind works by delays and priorities. An item having a low priority is held until the circuits are cleared and ready for it. To put it bluntly, I am subject to double takes. I was several blocks away before I reviewed the swimming pool datum. It had not been much. The gates were locked, and it carried a sign, "Closed for the season." A swimming pool closed down during the hottest part of the summer? What did it mean? Nothing at all. Swimming pools have gone out of business before and will again. On the other hand, it was contrary to the logic of economics to close such an enterprise during the season of greatest profit, except through utter necessity. The odds against it were long. But a swimming pool is the one place where the masquerade could not possibly be maintained. From the viewpoint of humans, a closed pool is less conspicuous than a pool unpatronized in hot weather. And I knew that the masters noted and followed the human point of view in their maneuvers. Shucks, I'd been there. Item. A trap at the city's toll gates. Item. Too few sunsuits. Item. A closed swimming pool. Conclusion. The slugs were incredibly more numerous than had been dreamed by anyone, including myself, who had been possessed by them. Corollary. Schedule counterblast was based on a mistaken estimate of the enemy, and would work as well as hunting rhinoceri with a slingshot. Counterargument. What I thought I saw was physically impossible. I could hear Secretary Martinez restrain sarcasm, tearing my report to shreds. My guesses referred only to Kansas City, and were insufficiently grounded even then. Thank you very kindly for your interest, but what you need is a long rest and freedom from nervous strain. Now, gentlemen... I had to have something strong enough for the old man to convince the president over the reasonable objections of his official advisors, and I had to have it right away. Even with the total disregard of traffic laws, I could not clip much off 2.5 hours running time back to Washington. What could I dig up that would be convincing? Go farther downtown, mingle with crowds, and then tell Martinez that I was sure that almost every man I passed was possessed? How could I prove it? For that matter, how could I myself be certain? I did not have Mary's special talent. As long as the Titans kept up the farce of business as usual, the telltales would be subtle. A superabundance of round shoulders. A paucity of bare ones. True, there was the tollgate trap. I had some notion now of how the city had been saturated, granting a large enough supply of slugs. I felt sure that I would encounter another such trap on the way out, and that there would be others like it on launching platforms, and at every other entrance and exit to the city proper. Every person leaving would be a new agent for the masters. Every person entering would be a new slave. This I felt sure of, without being inclined to test it by visiting a launching platform. I had once set up such a trap in the Constitution Club. No one who entered it had escaped. I had noticed a vendo printer for the Kansas City Star on the last corner I had passed. Now I swung around the block and came back to it. Pulled up, and got out. I shoved a dime in the slot and waited for my paper to be printed. It seemed to take unusually long, but that was my own nervousness. I felt that every passerby was staring at me. The Star's format had its usual dull respectability. No excitement, no mention of an emergency, no reference to schedule bareback. The lead news story was headed, "Phone service disrupted by sunspot storm," with a subhead, "City semi-isolated by solar static." There was a three-column, semi-stereo true color of the sun, its face disfigured by cosmic acne. The pic carried a Palomar dateline, as did one of the sub-stories. The picture was a good fake, or perhaps they pulled a real one out of the paper's library. It added up to a convincing and unexciting explanation of why Mammy Schultz, herself free of parasites, could not get her call through to Grandma in Pittsburgh. The rest of the paper looked normal. I tucked it under my arm to study later and turned back to my car. just as a police car glided silently up and cramped in across the nose of it. A cop got out. A police car seems to condense a crowd out of air. A moment before, the corner was deserted, else I would have never stopped. Now there were people all around, and the cop was coming toward me. My hand crept closer to my gun. I would have dropped him had I not been sure that most, if not all, of those around me were equally dangerous. He stopped in front of me. "Let's see your license," he said pleasantly. "Certainly, officer," I agreed. "It's clipped to the instrument board of my car." I stepped past him, letting it be assumed that he would follow me. I could feel him hesitate, then take the bait. I led him around to the far side between my car and his. This let me see that he did not have a mate in his car, a most welcome variation from human practice. More important, it placed my car between me and the two innocent bystanders. "Right there," I said, pointing inside. "It's fastened down." Again he hesitated, then looked, just long enough for me to use the new technique I developed through necessity. My left hand slapped down on his shoulders, and I clutched with all my strength. It was the struck cat all over again. His body seemed to explode, so violent was the spasm. I was in the car and gunning it almost before he hit the pavement. And none too soon. The masquerade broke as suddenly as it had in Barnes's outer office. The crowd closed in. One young woman clung by her nails to the smooth outside of the car for 50 feet or more before she fell off. By then I was making speed and still accelerating. I cut in and out of oncoming traffic, ready to take to the air but lacking space. A cross street showed up on the left. I slammed into it. It was a mistake. Trees arched over it, and I could not take off. The next turn was even worse. I cursed the city planners who had made Kansas City so park-like. Of necessity, I slowed down. Now I was cruising at a conservative city speed, still watching for a street which would carry me to some boulevard wide enough for an illegal takeoff. My thoughts began to catch up with me, and I realized that there was no sign of pursuit. My own too intimate knowledge of the masters came to my mind. Except for direct conference, a titan lives in and through his host. He sees what the host sees, receives and passes on information through whatever organs and by whatever means are available to the host. I knew that. So I knew that it was unlikely that any of the slugs at the corner had been looking for that particular car, other than the one inhabiting the body of a policeman, and I had settled with it. Now, of course, the other parasites present would be on the lookout for me, too, but they had only the bodily abilities and facilities of their hosts. I decided that I need treat them with no more respect, or only a little more respect, than I would give to any casual crowd of witnesses, i.e. ignore them. Change neighborhoods and forget it. For I had 30 minutes of grace left, and had decided what it was I needed as proof. A prisoner. A man who had been possessed. I could tell what had happened to the city. I had to rescue a host. I had to capture a man who was possessed. Capture him without hurting him, kill or remove his rider, and kidnap him back to Washington. I had not time to pick a victim, to make plans. I must act, now. Even as I decided, I saw a man walking in the block ahead. He was carrying a briefcase and stepped along like a man who sees home and supper ahead. I pulled alongside him and said, "Hey." He stopped. "Huh?" I said, "I've just come from City Hall. No time to explain. Slide in here, and we'll have a direct conference." He answered, "City Hall? What are you talking about?" I said, "Changing plans. Don't waste time. Get in." He backed away. I jumped out of the car and grabbed his hunched shoulders. Nothing happened. Nothing. Save that my hand struck bony human flesh, and the man began to yell. I jumped back into the car and got out of there fast. When I was blocks away, I slowed and thought it over. Could it be that I was wrong? That my nerves were so overwrought that I saw signs of titans where there were none? No. For the moment, I had the old man's indomitable will to face facts, to see them as they were. The toll gate, the sunsuits, the swimming pool, the cop at the window printer. Those facts I knew. And this last fact simply meant that I had hit the 00, rolled boxcars, picked the 1 man in 10, or whatever the odds were, who was not yet recruited. I speeded up, looking for a new victim. He was a middle-aged man watering his lawn, a figure so bucolic and out of this century that I was half a mind to pass him by. But I had no time left, and he wore a heavy sweater which bulged suspiciously. Had I seen his wife on the veranda, I would have gone past, for she was dressed in bra and shirt, and so could not have been possessed. He looked up inquiringly as I stopped. "I've just come from City Hall," I repeated. "You and I need a direct conference right away. Get in." He said quietly, "Come in the house for it. The car is too public." I wanted to refuse, but he had already turned and was heading for the house. As I came up by him, he whispered, "Careful. The woman is not of us." "Your wife?" "Yes." We stopped on the porch, and he said, "My dear, this is Mr. O'Keefe. We have some business to discuss. We'll be in the study." She smiled and answered, "Certainly, my love. Good evening, Mr. O'Keefe. Sultry, isn't it?" I agreed that it was, and she went back to her knitting. We went on inside, and the man ushered me into his study. Since we were both keeping the masquerade, I went in first, as befitted a visitor being escorted. I did not like turning my back on him. For that reason, I was half expecting it. He hit me near the base of the neck, but I rolled with it and went down almost unhurt. I continued to roll and fetched up on my back. In training school, they used to slap us with sandbags for trying to get up, once down. I recall my savate instructor saying in a flat Belgian accent, "Brave men get up again and die. Be a coward. Fight from the floor." So I went on my back and threatened him with my heels as soon as I hit. He danced back out of range. Apparently he did not have a gun, and I could get to mine. But there was an open fireplace in the room, a real one, complete with poker, shovel, and tongs. He circled toward it. There was a small table just out of my reach. I half rolled, half lunged, grabbed a leg and threw it. It caught him in the face as he was grabbing the poker. Then I was on him. His master was dying in my fingers, and he himself was convulsing under its last, terrible command when I became aware of nerve-shattering screams. His wife was standing in the doorway. I bounced up and let her have one, right about her double chin. She went down in mid-scream, and I returned to her husband. A limp man is amazingly hard to lift. It took me longer to get him up and across my shoulders than it had to silence him. He was heavy. Fortunately, I'm a big husky, all hands and feet. I managed a lumbering dog trot toward the car. I doubt if the noise of our fight disturbed anyone but my victim's wife, but her screams must have aroused half that end of town. There were people popping out of doors on both sides of the street. So far, none of them was near, but I was glad to see that I had left the car door open. I hurried toward it. Then I was sorry. A brat who looked like the twin of the one who had given me trouble earlier was inside, fiddling with the controls. Cursing, I dumped my prisoner in the lounge circle and grabbed at the kid. The boy shrank back and struggled. But I tore him loose and threw him out, straight into the arms of the first of my pursuers. That saved me. He was still untangling himself as I slammed into the driver's seat and shot forward without bothering with door or safety belt. As I took the first corner, the door swung shut, and I almost went out of my seat. I then held a straight course long enough to fasten the belt. I cut sharp on another corner, nearly ran down a ground car coming out, and went on. I found the wide boulevard I needed, the Paseo, I think, and jabbed the takeoff key. Possibly I caused several wrecks. I had no time to worry about it. Without waiting to reach altitude, I wrestled her to course east and continued to climb as I made easting. I kept her on manual across Missouri and expended every launch unit in her racks to give her more speed. That reckless and illegal action may have saved my neck. Somewhere over Columbia, just as I fired the last one, I felt the car shake to concussion. Someone had launched an interceptor. A devil chaser would be my guess. And the pesky thing had fused where I had just been. There were no more shots, which was good, as I would have been a duck on water from then on. My starboard impeller began to run hot immediately thereafter. Possibly from the near miss, or perhaps simply from abuse. I let it heat, praying that it would not fly apart for another 10 minutes. Then, with the Mississippi behind me and the indicator way up into danger, I cut it out and let the car limp along on the port unit. 300 was the best she would do, but I was out of zone red and back among free men. Up until then, I had not had time to give my passenger more than a glance. He lay where I'd slung him, sprawled on the floor pads, unconscious or dead. Now that I was back among men and no longer had the power for illegal speeds, there was no reason not to go on automatic. I flipped on the transponder, signaled a request for block assignment, and put the controls on automatic without waiting for permission. A block control technician might curse me out and even note my signal for a citation, but they would fit me into the system somehow. I swung around into the lounge and looked my man over. He was breathing, but still out. There was a welt on his face where I'd clipped him with a table, but no bones seemed broken, and I doubted that he would be unconscious from that cause. I slapped his face and dug my thumbnails into his earlobes, but could not rouse him. The dead slug was beginning to stink, but I had no way to dispose of it. I let him be and went back to the control seat. The chronometer read 21:37 Washington time, and I still had better than 600 miles to go. At my best speed on one power plant, allowing nothing for landing, for tearing over to the White House and finding the old man, I would reach Washington a few minutes after midnight. So I had already failed to carry out the letter of my orders, and the old man was sure as the devil going to make me stay in after school for it. I took a chance and tried to start the starboard impeller. No dice. It was probably frozen solid. I needed a major overhaul. Perhaps just as well, as anything that goes that fast can be explosively dangerous if it gets out of balance. So I desisted and tried to raise the old man by phone. The phone would not work. Perhaps I had jiggered it in one of the spots of exercise I had been forced to take that day, but I had never had one fail me before. Printed circuits, transistors, and the whole works being embedded in a plastic made those units almost as shock-resistant as a proximity fuse. I put it back in my pocket, feeling that this was one of those days when it was just not worthwhile to get out of bed. I turned to the car's communicator and punched the emergency tab. "Control," I called out. "Control, this is an emergency." The screen lit up, and I was looking at a young man. He was, I saw with relief, bare-skinned so far as he appeared in the screen. "Control answering. Block Fox 11. "What are you doing in the air? I've been trying to raise you ever since you entered my block." "Never mind," I snapped. "Patch me into the nearest military circuit. This is crash priority." He looked uncertain, but the screen flickered and went blank. Shortly, another picture built up, showing a military message center. And that did my heart good, as every person in sight was stripped to the waist. The foreground was occupied by a young watch officer. I could have kissed him. Instead, I said, "Military emergency. Patch me through to the Pentagon, and there to the White House." "Who are you?" "No time, no time. I'm a civil agent, and you wouldn't recognize my ID if you saw it. Hurry." I might have talked him into it, but he was shouldered out of scan by an older man, a wing commander by his cap insignia. "Land at once," was all that he said. "Look, Skipper," I said, "this is a military emergency. You've got to put me through. This is a military emergency," he interrupted. "And all civil craft have been grounded for the past 3 hours. Land at once." "But I've got to..." "Land or be shot down. We're tracking you. I'm about to launch an interceptor to burst a half a mile ahead of you. Hold your course, or make any maneuver but landing. The next one will burst on." "Will you listen, please? I'll land, but I've got to get..." He switched off, leaving me with my jaw pumping air. The first burst seemed considerably short of a half a mile ahead of me. I landed. I cracked up in doing it, but without hurting myself or my passenger. I did not have to wait long. They had me flare-lighted and were swooping down on me before I had satisfied myself that the boat wouldn't moat. They took me in, and I met the wing commander personally. He even put my message through after his psych squad got through giving me the antidotes for the sleep test. But then it was 1:13, Zone 5, and schedule counterblast had been underway for exactly 1 hour and 13 minutes. The old man listened to a summary, grunted, then told me to shut up and see him in the morning.